You're listening to episode 10 of season 7 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is season 7, episode 10, GNU World Order. What is GNU World Order? Well, it's a technical podcast about GNU and about Linux and Unix and anything geeky like that. My name is Klaatu, I'll be your friendly host today, as I am pretty much every episode. Today in this episode we're going to talk about a lot of different things, including Emacs, the built-in calendaring and journal or diary function in GNU Emacs. We'll also be talking about Sabayon Linux and performance of Kden Live and a couple of tips, and of course some listener feedback. And we might as well just start with the listener feedback, so away we go. So first I got a note from Deep Geek, who of course you'll know from Talk Geek to Me podcast, possibly HPR if you go that far back. Deep Geek says that he was very interested in my talk about the backup situation, and I mean he's talked about backing up before, and one of his big things in the past, at least, I mean I guess he's kind of settled into maybe a file system now, but he used to really try out the different file systems that were kind of up and coming, and he did an episode of something on a file system which was really interesting. But even now, but especially at the time that I heard that episode, and I don't remember what show that was on or whatever, but it's way over my head. I don't understand file systems enough to understand how to manipulate them on some kind of level where you can take advantage of automatic snapshots and stuff like that. I don't know what a snapshot is. I mean, I know what a snapshot is, but I don't know what a file system snapshot is, or how to invoke it, or how to revert back to it, or whatever. Anyway, he's talking about NILFS, N-I-L-F-S, and I've not tried that and haven't really heard about it all that much, and wouldn't even know how to implement it if I was interested. A little bit more mainstream, however, he kind of mentions the file system ZFS. That's, of course, originally the Sun Microsystem file system that has made it into BSD. I don't know how many BSDs, but I was actually just playing around with PC BSD the other day, and that was one of your options as your default file system, ZFS. So it's there. You can play around with it. It's not that difficult to get if you really want to try it. But apparently it's got a lot of cool features, which again, unfortunately, I don't quite get it. You know, I don't quite understand how all that stuff works, but there's a bunch of cool features in there, and apparently it's kind of got a normal, you know, Unix-y kind of way of using it. It takes input from standard in, it gives output back out to standard out, so you can pipe it in any direction you want. Again, I don't know how to do it. He kind of gave me a sample command, which sounds really cool, but it looked pretty much like Greek to me. But I do intend to play around with some of that stuff eventually. I don't know if I'll play around with ZFS, not because of any bias against ZFS, it's just that it's harder to get than, say, ButterFS, which I think last time I installed Fedora was literally one of the options as your default file system. Either Fedora or OpenSUSE, I don't remember which one it was that I was playing around with. So anyway, very, very interesting topic, file systems, and something that I don't really know a whole lot about, and I don't see myself getting into anytime soon, because it seems like that's a whole other branch of research and study that, while it's very applicable to everyone's life, because it is, after all, your data that you're trying to preserve, I don't see myself going down that path quite yet. I'm still kind of on to the whole multimedia thing, so I think I'll probably just keep concentrating on that for the time being. But that doesn't alter the fact that it's a fascinating, fascinating study. Doru Barbu wrote me about the desktop folder thing. Remember last episode I was musing about how confusing it seemed to have a desktop folder and yet to have your desktop, you know, the files on your desktop. And he mentioned that maybe I was even looking at it the wrong way around. Rather than saying I've got a desktop folder and it is also on my screen as a desktop, I should look at it the other way. You've got this desktop and you also have it reflected as a folder so that you can then arrange them by date modified or arrange them by name alphabetically within that folder, but the physical placement of those icons on your desktop remains unaltered. So that's a good point. It's one of those points that I just kind of have to accept, because no matter what, it's just not how I'm going to use my computer. I don't like having stuff on my desktop, and so it's not going to be an issue for me, and so that desktop folder is extraneous pretty much no matter what. On a vaguely similar note, Martin emailed me and asked an interesting question. and it has to do with UI, or UX, I guess. He says, in your opinion, meaning my opinion, in your opinion, what is the best way to develop user interfaces? Should we continue to develop existing ideas, the WIMP model, W-I-M-P, or should we try new and experimental stuff, i.e. Unity? Does such new and revolutionary thought lead to a mass adoption of GNU Linux or other free operating systems? If the developers come up with some new ideas that attain the status of a killer app, then we would see a big increase in the user base. And he says, from his experience, most new GNU Linux users get used to a GNOME KDE interface in about 15 minutes. And this is due to their familiarity from the existing WIMP model that is used by the big commercial operating systems. If we try and do something really experimental and make it really good technically and with a good human interface guideline, then we might have the chance of getting significant boost in the user base. And that's his point. And he's from Sofia, Bulgaria, no less, which is really, really neat. So, I mean, that's probably a whole show's worth of commentary, but it would be pretty boring and repetitive, but I mean, it's just one of those questions, you know, it's like one of those $64,000 questions. It's just such a huge, huge thing. And I mean, the first reaction is, yeah, we should innovate. We should be crazy and different and new. And, you know, then you get something like Fluxbox, which, I mean, it's crazy and innovative and new, you know, I mean, it really is a different model. Someone sits down in front of that, it's completely different than what they're used to, and it would take, I guess, a normal person a long time to get used to that. And then there are so many different workflows for Fluxbox anyway. You know, do you give it so many additional features that it becomes almost like a desktop, or do you keep it as a window manager and run a whole bunch of little apps within it? You know, how do you work that out for yourself? So, of course, it's also kind of like, well, what user are you assuming is coming to the table? If that user isn't in the mood to learn anything new at all, regardless of whether it's easier, then it's going to be difficult to convince them that that's a better way of working, because a lot of times, for a lot of people, better equals the same. My first instinct still is, yeah, the new interfaces and the new paradigms are really, really important, because that's, of course, where it is all going. And if you look at something like the mobile phone market, or not the market, good gosh, let's not look at the market, but markets are boring, but the mobile phone space, then you've got a completely different paradigm, right? There is no desktop on the mobile phone, on the device. There's no file folders, you know, it's completely different. Frankly, for me, it's very disturbing. I pretty much hate it. But a lot of people seem to really, really like it, and it's that app-centric, and I don't even mean that in a sarcastic sort of, like, derogatory way. It is app-centric, meaning you go to your storage place of all your different applications, and you launch the different applications straight out of that one big repository of executable applications. If you've hacked your phone and there is a file folder kind of view, or maybe you can even do that to some degree with just the SD card. But if you download, you know, a file manager of some sort, then you can click on that file manager and it will launch in a list view all the different files that you have on your SD card or whatever. But I think either way, the push within the people releasing these mobile operating systems is not that. It's not the, here's your collection of data. It's, here's your collection of apps, and here's the data that is applicable to those applications. So if you want to see your photos, you don't go to your files and look in your photo folder. You open your gallery or your camera app and then click on the gallery tab. You know, whatever. It's completely different, and yet, bottom line is that it's been rapidly, rapidly, famously rapidly adopted by normal users, and they've gotten it. They've been able to understand what they're supposed to do. They can manage their own data, and it just kind of works. Now, whether it works for people's real, honest data, I think it differs from person to person. A lot of people, for many people, their data consists of just kind of whatever random photo they happen to take within the past week that they still care about because they haven't forgotten about it. And then next week, if they lost that phone, you'd be like, aren't you worried about your data? And they'd just be like, oh, I didn't have any data on there. It was just a phone. You know, so I mean, I don't know that this interface is the primary interface for a lot of people. Whereas if someone loses their computer, a lot of times you'll hear a lot more about, oh my gosh, my term paper was on there. My journal was on there. You know, whatever. People's real life data is on are on those bigger devices. So I don't know if that interface of, hey, don't worry about your data, just think about your apps. I don't know if that works on a long-term kind of serious, like hardcore computer user level or not. And I think that maybe remains to be seen. But of course, the segue, the natural segue from the phone interface would be to Linux's very own GNOME 3 interface, which in my view is fairly innovative. Like if you think about, look at all the controversy that it's generated. So it's obviously something. It's obviously something different. And it's making a lot of people very angry, but it's making a lot of other people really, really happy. It's making me very happy. It's making all my friends who look over my shoulder at my GNOME 3 desktop very happy. So it is obviously different. It's doing things remarkably different. And it's working, I think. And I think that it's a really good example of how it can work really well. And I mean, I'm not making this stuff up. When I've sat down with two different people who really don't know a whole lot about computers, and they were both able to either catch on to what I was doing really, really fast, or in one case, like the multilingual support, he was able to show me how to turn on multilingual support via the system settings that he'd never touched before. He just kind of knew where it was on other operating systems, even though this was completely different, even though I had to maybe show him how to launch the system settings. Once he was in there, he could navigate around. So there's like this balance of like familiar paradigm with completely new and bizarre and yet easy to grasp things. So I think that's significant. I think if people are shooting for completely familiar interfaces and stuff like that, that seems like a good idea. It seems very safe. It seems very, very friendly, very non-obtrusive. But I also think it's deceptive, because if you sit down and everything's totally familiar, and to you, a dumb computer user, everything looks pretty much the same, and then you go to do something like download that .exe that you just gotta have off of the internets, because it's going to be your bonsai buddy and you want to install that thing, and it doesn't install, then suddenly the whole thing was a lie to you. This computer that looked so familiar to you and seemed to act so normal is now something completely different, and for a lot of people, different equals broken. And so it's not a good thing. And I think it's time for Linux to stop trying to undersell itself and to kind of come in as a wolf in sheep's clothing. We're not another operating system. This isn't just like every other operating system, so don't worry, you can start using it, you won't notice anything. Yes, you'll notice something different, and you should. Linux is a better way of working. It's more practical, it's more efficient, it's more secure, or it can be. It's a lot of different things. It's not your other operating system. If you don't like that idea, if you can't handle that idea, then don't come to Linux, because you're not ready for it. Stay on your old OS until you get so frustrated that you are looking for something different. Linux is different. It should look different. It should act differently. It should feel different. And so its interface is okay to be different. Whether the interface is okay to be stupid or not, and if it's okay to be broken and over complex or under complex or whatever, those are completely different issues. But in terms of, is it okay to be different and innovative, then yeah, I think that's a great idea. Martin cites specifically Unity, and I have to say that when I first tried Unity, I don't know if I actually spoke about this on the show or not, or whether it was something I had just said in IRC, I don't remember. When I first tried Unity, I was actually really impressed with it at first, because it was different, it was pretty, it had the top menu bar. I was impressed. I was really impressed, and I didn't expect it to be impressed, because I'd heard nothing but bad things about it. And so I was fine with Unity. I'm not fine with it only being available on one distribution necessarily. I mean, that I'm fine with that sort of intellectually, because I don't actually want to run Unity, but practically I'm not. No, practically I'm okay with it. Intellectually I'm not, because if people do like Unity, and if you're trying to push Unity, then it should be on other Linux distributions, and the fact that it is only really apparently functional on Ubuntu is really strange and disconcerting. But none of that really matters, because after, 2 weeks after I tried Unity, I tried GNOME 3. And GNOME 3 just, honestly, it blew Unity out of the water in terms of user-friendliness, prettiness. I don't know if better or worse in terms of efficiency. Neither of them struck me as particularly efficient. But in terms of everything else, GNOME 3 just, it really felt a lot more cohesive and a lot more polished, and just kind of really knowing what direction it's going in, apart from Unity. So I don't, in terms of Martin specifically citing Unity, I don't know how I would feel about that as our big example of Linux desktops being innovative. I find GNOME 3 a lot more innovative. Its only drawback really is that it doesn't have that top menu bar. But, you know, this new HUD idea that Mark Shuttleworth is kind of promoting, it works really well, actually. I mean, I haven't used it, but I've used it in Blender. I mean, it's the same idea. You press the space bar, you get a search box, you type in the command that you're trying to invoke, and it gives you the suggestions for that. It doesn't really help you learn the keyboard shortcuts in its current implementation, but that's a minor thing. The point is that in terms of efficiency and screen real estate and annoyance factor, I find a HUD heads-up display really, really efficient. It just pops up where your cursor is, gives you a whole bunch of options, and it's all very fast and cool. I think that would be innovative to have that across the whole system. I think that would be a really, really great thing. So, yeah, I guess the bottom line is that I'm really, really okay with innovative, different user interfaces. And I think that the only problem with them is when you start to feel embarrassed about them and start apologizing for them because you feel like Linux should be exactly like another OS. And the problem there is that there are two other OSs, and it can't be both of those things. And those two OSs are things that we are running from, and so why should we try to emulate them completely? Obviously, some ideas are great, top menu bar being one of them. Some things we would want to emulate, but I don't think there's any reason to think that we have to be exactly like a user's old environment, because it's time for us to just stand up and say, no, we're not like your old environment. We are different, and the appearance of it is just the beginning. There's a whole level of code that you don't even understand or want to understand that's completely different, and trust us, it's better. Code is better, the interface is better, and so if you want to get on board, come on board, and if not, then stay on your old OS. No hard feelings. I don't think that that's a problem. So thank you for your question, Martin. Very, very cool question. Really got me thinking. So much so, in fact, that I didn't really respond to him for like 2 weeks. It was really something that I had to really ponder. So really great question there. Not that the other questions weren't great. I like all your questions and suggestions. Okay, so the final listener feedback, which isn't really going to be a listener feedback as much as it's going to be a segue into the next topic for the show, came from Raven again. Raven I mentioned on the last episode as well. I think he was talking to me about Salix OS versus Sabayon versus whatever. And it turns out that he ended up, because his other choices were not bringing X up in proper resolution and things like that. So he ended up going with Sabayon because Sabayon just had a new release, Sabayon 8, I think it is. And when he popped it into the computer and installed it, it just worked. Everything worked. It had the drivers that it needed. It displayed the correct resolution. Just everything just kind of worked. For a new user, obviously, that's a really, really big deal. And for someone who doesn't want to sit down and figure out how to, I don't know, I think, I'm gathering from this situation, it would have taken a Telinet 3, and then remove and blacklist the Nuvo driver, and then install the NVIDIA proprietary driver. That's what I'm guessing. I don't know this for sure. This is what it's sounding like to me. Possibly setting a no mode set to even get this far. Install the NVIDIA driver, blacklist Nuvo, and then reboot or start the NVIDIA driver, mod probe it, and then start X back up. That's kind of what I'm guessing would have been the solution, but if you're not into that, then a distribution that just kind of works out of the box is really, really nice, kind of a lifesaver. And just for people who maybe are in this situation where they are trying a distribution and it just doesn't seem to be working as spectacularly as everyone seems to be saying that it should work, then yeah, go to distrowatch.whatever.com, I think, and look for a new release of one of the sort of, you know, big or semi-big distributions. Because a lot of times what happens is that all you really need is a new kernel or a more diverse set of drivers to choose from, something like that, or even just a more updated set of drivers to choose from. And if you're booting from, for instance, Fedora 16, which at this point is only about 6 months old, and yet, you know, at the rate that all these manufacturers are coming out with either new or just slightly tweaked chipsets for this or that, sometimes that's all it takes is like 1 month release, you know, a release that's just 5 or 4 months later than all those components that, for instance, Fedora 16 shipped with, or whatever. So in picking your, I guess, first or super easy sort of out-of-the-box distribution, sometimes the newer releases are really good ideas because they just have access to later drivers, later kernel, things like that. Not that you couldn't get there from an older release. Like, you could take Fedora 16, strip out the bad driver, insert the new one, or you could ditch the old kernel, update to a new one. You know, you could do that, but you might be doing all of that on a command line. If you're not looking to do that, and you just kind of want to get on Linux, starting to use the desktop, and just kind of get familiar with the environment, whatever, sometimes finding a very, very recent release of a Linux distribution is just what your computer will need in order for all of those components to be recognized and configured properly automatically for you. So I thought that was a good sort of roundabout tip that kind of, it's, I don't know Raven's exact situation, but that's what it made me think of anyway. So anyway, he settled on Sabayon, which I'd always thought was a French distribution because Sabayon sounds French. Well, apparently it's not at all. It's Sabayon is actually an Italian dessert, and so the spelling of Sabayon is sort of a play on that, apparently. But anyway, I decided that Sabayon might be worth a look because I just kept seeing the name pop up. I mean, I know that whenever something announces on DistroWatch, people start talking about it, you know, and you start to see it on all the usual Linux sites and those chronic distro hoppers all rush to try it. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But I started to kind of hear a lot about it and I started to think, well, I haven't looked at Sabayon in a long time. In fact, a very long time. I think the last time that I had installed Sabayon was when I first started on Linux. It was one of the distributions that I tried. I remember being impressed with it. I never had a bad taste from Sabayon, which is an Italian dessert, so bad taste. Anyway, it never really left me with a bad feeling or anything, so I remember liking it. If I recall correctly, the reason I ultimately did not go with it was because I just felt like it wasn't big enough, and I was really worried about getting enough support, you know? Like, I was trying to figure out, I could dual boot my laptop with two things. One was going to be Slackware because I wanted to learn that, and the other was going to be something that would be my fallback Linux distribution. And so I didn't want to go with something obscure because I wanted to make sure that, you know, if that school paper couldn't be completed because of some weird issue with logging in, I could jump online on another computer, look up the problem, fix it, and get back to work. So that was the logic there. So I never went back to Sabayon exactly. And I'm in the situation now where a friend is building a computer specifically for Linux. It's going to be a Linux home-built, home-brewed computer from just the parts. He's going to put it all together and install something on it. Now, he knows that I'm a big fan of Slackware and a big fan of Fedora, so those were kind of the two that we were kind of thinking might be good for him. But the one that he saw looking over my shoulder at the time, my laptop running a live USB stick, was Fedora 16 with GNOME 3. This was a couple of months ago, around Christmas time. So the thing that had kind of pushed him over the edge of, okay, I'm building a Linux computer, was GNOME 3, specifically GNOME 3, the look and the feel of GNOME. So Slackware wasn't going to be an option because getting GNOME 3 on Slackware was just not something I wanted to do right now with my time. And Fedora was going to be the one, right? And I thought, seems okay, I'll just put him on Fedora 15 with GNOME 3, you know? That way, none of that cutting-edge riskiness with Fedora 16. But I just kept feeling like there are going to be updates to Fedora 16 or 15, and updates on Fedora make me nervous, you know? When you update, you kind of just, you're ready for breakage, because they don't mess around when they do updates. Once again, that's why I run Fedora. But it's also why I don't run Fedora on my multimedia, you know, my actual machines, the ones that I go to when there's a rush job that needs to be done and I need to edit something or pump out some 30-second music for some silly PSA or whatever, you know? So I felt a little bit hesitant to put him on Fedora, even though I've said in the past that Fedora seems like a great environment for new users because it's so pretty and friendly and all that other stuff. And I felt, especially since this was going to be long distance, I felt nervous about having to support that, being like the guy who he's going to call when something breaks on Fedora. So I was kind of putting my feelers out for some for an alternative, for a more stable alternative. Fortuitously, Sabayon Linux kept kind of popping up in IRC, in my email, stuff like that. So took a look at it once I found out that it actually has a GNOME 3 version that you can download and install. Downloaded, installed it on a test box, and I have to say that I was really, really impressed. I was just as pleased as punch. It's a really slick distribution. I didn't mean to try it necessarily. I probably won't use it myself, but I think that it might be something that I have other people try. I'll probably keep it on a test box for a little while just so that I can get familiar with it enough to support it, but it is really, really nice. It installs easily. It actually uses Anaconda for the installer, so it's really easy install, very familiar if you're an Anaconda user, which is, of course, the one that comes with Fedora and Red Hat, so it's a very familiar install process. And once you're finished the install, it boots into the system, and it's great. It works really, really well. Almost too well. It's really bizarre. It doesn't get into that whole... It felt a little bit, in a way, like Mint. You know, it didn't really care so much about... I'm pretty sure it installed an NVIDIA driver without really warning me about the proprietariness of it. It just kind of works, and I think because it's a European-based distribution, they don't really sweat the details too much, like Fedora would, for instance. So it just really, really worked. Like, on every level, it just magically worked. Because of what I'm looking for, which is something quick and easy that I don't have to really worry about that much, I'm going to just kind of turn a blind eye to all of that and say that that's okay. Even more significantly, I installed Kden Live, a couple of other multimedia-type applications, and they just installed. I fired them up. They just worked. It was really, really a pleasant experience. Again, not really something that I would do personally, because it didn't feel like I had enough control over the configure side of things, mainly because I don't know Emerge and stuff like that, so I wouldn't probably use it for myself. I mean, yeah, I'm not in the market for that kind of experience for myself, but for other people, I may very well be in the market for that, and Sabayon looks like a really, really powerful contender. The other option, of course, would have been like Magia or Mandriva, something along those lines, and I was really thinking of that, but I don't know what's going on with Mandriva and Magia. I'm not sure where those... what's going to happen with that sort of split. I don't even know how Magia is handling GNOME 3 right now. I don't know if it's doing anything with GNOME 3 at all. So Sabayon was kind of like the quick and easy solution, quite possibly. I haven't installed the thing yet. The computer isn't built, so I haven't put it on my friend's computer yet. So it's still a little bit up in the air. But I'm going to keep test driving it, mostly in class when I'm showing my students how to edit, basic editing technique and stuff like that. I do that on Kden Live, so I'll be giving it that kind of test drive, which is always exciting because if you've ever done any kind of demonstration, you know that if something's going to break, that's when it's going to break, when you're in front of 20 people showing them how to edit HD footage and then everything falls apart. So we'll see how it lasts in class, and if it survives that test, then I think it'll probably get on my friend's computer and be his main operating environment, which is kind of neat. I never really thought of myself as a Sabayon supporter or a Gentoo supporter by any means, so it was kind of interesting to be dabbling with that. But it really is nice, and it doesn't have a reputation by any means of being cutting edge or anything like that, so I'm hoping that it'll be a nice, stable kind of environment for this person. We'll see what happens. But first, we'll have a cup of coffee. Yes, that's right. There's nothing that goes quite as good with Linux as does a cup of coffee. So go get yourself one, come right back, and we'll pick up the show. To mention something that, once again, I've kind of already covered on the blog over at Ogcast Planet, so I'm not going to dwell on this again because you might have already read it, but it is a worthwhile tip, I think, and that is that on Kden Live, if you're using Kden Live and you are editing, for instance, HD footage, then if you are editing and you are experiencing choppy playback, like it'll play for 8 frames, and then it'll stop, and then it'll go again, and then it'll keep it'll stop and then keep going. If you're experiencing that, this is called, in other editing programs, they call it real-time playback. It's pretty much a given these days that you get real-time playback, meaning, or at least in other editing software, that refers to the fact that if you turn on real-time playback, the editing program will do whatever it takes to ensure that your playback is smooth. If it means dropping frames, it will do that. If it means rendering really, really ugly and just kind of like a quick render of some kind of effect or something, it'll do that. It gives priority to 24 frames per second or whatever it is, 29.97 frames per second, whatever your the playback rate of that video in that timeline should be. That's what it gives priority to. That's what we call real-time playback in other editing software packages that I have ever encountered. KadenLive apparently decided that that means the opposite in KadenLive. I'm not really sure the logic. I'm kind of guessing, and this is a huge stretch for me, but maybe real-time means not real-time, R-E-E-L, but real-time, so this is what it's going to look like when it's actually played back as your final render, so maybe it's spending more time rendering each frame so that it's full quality, and then the drop frame thing. I mean, drop frame means something very specific in video terms. It means something very specific. Drop frame is a concept in the way that video is translated, so I'm assuming that maybe drop frames means that they're going to drop frames from playback at this point. So if you have it checked on, it's showing you full quality and it's throwing frames away that it can't keep up with or something. It makes no sense to me anyway. Point being that it's the opposite of what you of what a video person would think that means. So if you're throwing HD footage at your editor and you know that the computer should be able to handle HD footage, for instance, if you can play that clip in MPlayer outside of KadenLive and it plays back just fine, and yet when you pull it into KadenLive the thing stutters and stammers through every clip unbearably, so then obviously something's going on. So the fix is to select, there's a little gear icon under your clip monitor and your project monitor. So this isn't a global setting. This is something that you need to set for both the clip monitor when you're auditioning the clip and the project monitor when you're playing back your project. Little gear icon right next to the volume icon, and you click on that, and the last selection in that menu is real-time drop frames. Uncheck that. Take the check mark away, and that will ensure that your clip is being played in a pleasing and smooth fashion. This is confirmed on 0.8.0 of KadenLive and 0.8.2 on KadenLive. So if that changes in the future, I'll try to notice it and mention it on this show. But for now, that is the way that KadenLive works. And I say if it changes, because I just feel deep in my heart, I feel like that is a mistake. Like someone has real-time drop frames defaulting set to 1 when it should be set to 0, and then when you put the check mark in it, it switches to 0, and then when you take that checkbox, the check mark out, it goes back to 1. Something like that. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me the way that it's set up right now. You know, I'm assuming it's either a mistake or there's some kind of something happening on the programming level where this makes perfect sense, and it just so happens to conflict with what editors, when they're sitting around talking about frame rates and things like that, really think of when they hear those same exact terms in relation to one another. So we'll see what happens, but either way, it's not really that big of a deal. It's a little bit contrary to what you might think if you're used to these terms. So just reverse it and you're good. You're editing HD in real time again, or not in real time. I was looking at some calendaring stuff the other day just for fun, really. I don't really do a whole lot with calendars, and I don't need a whole lot out of a calendaring application. And for a while I was using Xcal, which is a pretty basic little calendaring application, more or less, for X. It's a really basic little application. It's got alerts, it'll pop up an alert if you've got an appointment set, stuff like that. So I don't really use it that often. But it kind of worked. And of course, Cal in the terminal is a good way to see the month that you're in. Just kind of get a feel for the dates and the days and stuff. Not really something I need a whole lot from. Those two applications typically suit things pretty well. I started finding myself more and more lately just living in Emacs. It's just so much can be done in Emacs. I just use it for so much at this point that I realized that I'd read somewhere online that there were some calendaring functions in GNU Emacs, and I thought I should try it. It might be too simple for some people. If you're used to a really robust, Cal-Dav-based calendaring thing where you can share calendars and do all this stuff, it might not be for you. But in terms of a simple calendar that isn't paper-based, it's perfect for me. And so to get there, you go to the Emacs menu. If you're either in an X-based Emacs, or if you're not, you can get there with the text menus. Or, of course, as always, you can just type in meta X and then type in calendar, and you'll get there as well. But however you get there, you can get there from the tools menu or from meta X calendar. I've used both, just depending on whether I'm in X or not. And choose the calendar selection. And at the bottom sort of mini buffer, it's not a mini buffer, it's more like maybe a third or maybe a fourth of your screen, right above the mini buffer at the bottom of the Emacs window, a little calendar pops up. And it's got 3 months, the current one in the middle, the previous and the next on the left and right, respectively. And it shows you all the days in the month, the Sundays and the Mondays and the Wednesdays, and it shows you all the dates, like all the numbers of each thing in the week. And it also gives you a new set of menus up at the top. So if you're in the calendar buffer, you'll notice that the menu options change at the top of your Emacs window. Again, whether you're an X or not, it doesn't really matter. But instead of just the normal, like, file and edit and buffers and tools, and I think, what's the other one, help, actually, tools and help. So instead of that sort of set of menus, you get new things like scroll, go to, holidays, diary, sun and moon, and I think that's it. So the thing that I started to use was what they're calling the diary entry. And so if you're in the bottom, or if you're in the calendar view of your menu, you can use Control F to go from day to day, or Control B to go back by a day. So if today's the, let's say the 18th, and I know that I have an appointment on the 20th, or something sort of in a to-do list on the 20th, then I could hit Control F. Now I'm on Monday the 20th, and then I could hit I for insert, D for diary. That makes my main buffer up in my main Emacs window switch over to the diary mode, and it gives me a date, and I can type in, it's the date that I'm entering a diary entry for. So I could enter whatever I have to do on that day. So maybe I have to set up the Sabayon box for an editing demo in a classroom. So that would be the 20th. I'll save that, Control X, Control S. And now I've got that listed in my little diary file, which you can actually define, like if you want a different diary to be your diary file, or if you want to switch back and forth between work appointments and normal life appointments, whatever. You have full control over that in the diary menu. You can use a different file. But for now, we'll just stick with one. So now if I get up on the 20th, come into work, sit down, open up Emacs, or it's probably already open from the previous day anyway, then I could go onto the date of the 20th and hit D for diary, and it will tell me, it will show me the diary entries that I have for that day. And it says Monday, February 20th. Oh, it's President's Day that day. That's funny. I didn't even know we still did President's Day. But yes, apparently it's a holiday of sorts on the 20th, and sure enough, I have an appointment or a task, I guess I could say, in the diary for whatever I want to do. It's pretty neat, actually. It's kind of fun. And where it gets really fun is that since the buffer, the main buffer of your little diary file is just an Emacs buffer, right? It's just a normal Emacs text entry thing. You can switch over to whatever mode that you want. Meaning Alt X or Meta X, whatever you want to call it, or dash mode puts you into something called fancy diary entries. And then you can do all of like the little checklists and things like that people seem to really like about org mode. And that becomes really fun because you now can make little lists that you can check off the tasks as you accomplish them. That's kind of a big thing with org mode, or you can really do anything, any org mode task that you want to do on that day. You know, whether you want it to be an outline for something or a checklist, or you want to put tags by things, whatever, however you want to manage it, you can. That's just how I've been using it lately. Go to the date, hit ID for insert diary, and then you're in the diary entry buffer, and then you can switch over to org mode and do whatever you want to inside of that org mode buffer. So it's really, really cool, really handy, and check it out if you're looking for a simple calendaring application. I don't know of any way to make it, like, alert you, you know, like if it's the 20th and I'm sitting around just messing around, not doing any work, and then it turns out that I'm missing an important meeting or something, which is completely imaginary because I don't go to meetings, but let's say that there's a meeting and I'm missing it. I don't know how to get Emacs to, like, flash text at me that says, you know, you're about to miss a meeting, go now to the meeting room. But I don't really use calendars that way. I rarely use calendars at all, but it's just kind of handy to put little notes to myself on individual days. That's kind of the extent of it for me right now. Once again, as with everything in Emacs, one of the nicest things about this diary application is that the diary entries themselves just get saved out into a plain text file. You can look at it completely independently of Emacs, much less Emacs as a calendar mode. There's nothing insisting that you use Emacs, or there's nothing saying, hey, if you make a mistake and you end up on a computer without Emacs on it, too bad, you don't get to look at your data. It's not like that. It's completely universal. So that's just a huge plus for me and for anyone else who cares about their data. So really, try that out if you're into Emacs, if you're getting into Emacs. Remember that it's the easiest way to get there, honestly, is just meta X and then type in the word calendar. But if you're in X and you want to use the toolbars, then you can go into tools, go down to calendar, it's at the bottom part of that menu, and you'll see the calendar right there. If you get back and, you know, if you're trying to get back and forth between the diary entry and the calendar entry, it's just control X and then O for other. And that's the same shortcut as anytime you're splitting your Emacs window up. You know, if you've done a vertical split, you want to get to one panel or the other, one buffer or the other, it's control X O for other. So that's the same way. So if I'm in the calendar view and I realize I didn't really mean to be in my calendar view, I wanted to go back to my calendar, my diary entry, then control X O, I'm back up in my diary entry, I can finish off whatever task I was typing in, control X O again, and I'm back down in the calendar, I can go forward a day. Well, I can't yet because I haven't saved it, so I'll save that. And then I'll go forward a day, and then I could insert another diary entry, whatever. So, great little tool. It's just one of those tiny little hidden features of Emacs that once you try it, especially if you're living in Emacs anyway, it's just one less reason to ever leave Emacs. So, enjoy. All right, we're getting very close to the ending of this episode, but before we get there, I wanted to talk a little bit about reviews and the culture, I guess, of either complaining or not complaining. And this is something that I kind of thought of when I was just browsing around some different news, like techie news sites. And I saw this couple of articles on some new and, quote, exciting, unquote, developments from corporately sponsored operating systems. And this is just kind of something that just keeps getting to me, and it's something that I can't really get away from because it's very ever-present, you know, either in tech news or just kind of in the air around technical environments. If you work around a lot of computers like I do, then it's something you hear about, and it's something that just never quite stops to bug me because I keep thinking, well, I keep seeing right through it. It's not that hard. If you have half a brain, you can see through it pretty quickly. And you see that half of the claims that a company is making are completely invented, and the other half are just very, very blown out of proportion. And even a half of those blown out of proportion are probably pre-existing anyway, and they've just kind of been spun differently. So it really gets on my nerves when I see this sort of thing, because people read it and they believe it. And I thought, why isn't there more of a culture of that kind of hyperbole within the GNU Linux community? Now, of course, hyperbole for most people has a negative connotation. And I think for most people it should. And I think the only people who really speak of hyperbole as a good thing are marketing people. And I'm not sure if that's really a good thing. So while it is very nice for marketing things to concentrate on the positive side of applications or operating systems or whatever they're releasing, I'm not sure if it's really always a good thing to be doing that, or it's a dangerous thing to do. Because I remember not too long ago, in fact, I was kind of thinking about different projects, free software projects, and how they sometimes promote themselves really a little bit better than they should, meaning that they design really slick websites and they make all these claims, you know, about how their software is this and it's that, and it's just, it's the bee's knees and it's the best and there's nothing better than it and it's doing all these things. And then you try it out and it's just like, it barely starts up. It's just all those promises that they seemed to be making out of pure excitement. You know, they're not selling you anything. There's nothing to gain for them by lying to you. But so I think it's earnest, just excitement about their own project, and they portray it as being much farther along than it really is. And that's a pity. That's a bad thing, because then you see it, you get essentially burned by it on a, usually a very, I mean, a lot of times I think it's a fairly small burn. You know, it's not like you committed all your data to that application, got halfway through your project, and then it crashed and burned and ate all your data. It's not that bad usually, but you still feel bad because you thought you'd found this great application. It looks so promising. Maybe you did spend a little bit of time getting the code and compiling it and installing it, and then you try it out and it's just nowhere near what you really had come to expect from their own marketing spiel on their website. So that can be a bad thing. And yet at the same time, I think that the big commercial operating systems are similarly guilty, because they will make things seem and sound magical. And while they might be at a certain stage, a lot of times if you really read what they're trying to claim things are going to do for your life, it's a complete non-starter. It's just completely blatantly false. And what they really mean is that if you do exactly what they want you to, then you'll be very happy. And I guess if free software projects would say that, then that'd be nice. You know, it's like, as long as you open this number of files that are no larger than this file size and make no more than 3 edits in the media and then export it within the first 15 minutes of having it opened, everything will run just fine. And then you're like, okay, well, it works as advertised. So marketing is it tends to be very, very loud, very boisterous, and usually very, very false. That's a given, and I think that happens no matter what, whether it's a free software project, whether it's paid marketing, whatever. The difference, I think, is that free software, since it's not selling anything, and since there is no marketing firm behind it to speak of, and it's being created by such a community, I think that a lot of people using the software are very open about the problems in that software, and they don't hide it, and they don't not talk about it. They talk about the problems, right? Not only do we talk about them, but we file bugs on them. So and the bug trackers are open. They're open to everyone to read. So not only are like bloggers talking about, you know, this issue that I found and here's the workaround and things like that, but you also get, you could also go and look at all the bugs filed, because they're just out in the open. And all of this is a good thing, but it feels like it's a bunch of negativity. You know, I mean, if you're doing a search on your favorite free software application and the first top 10 hits are posts about how someone can't get something to happen on this software, and then you do a search for some other non-free software of a similar ilk and the first top 10 hits are rave reviews about how brilliant the software is and how only the best use this software and how this software is going to change your life. I mean, if you bring those two search results up side by side, any person with any sense at all is going to choose the one that says all the great things, right? I mean, that's just how it works. So in other words, the perceived negativity isn't really negativity all the time. A lot of times it's simply that we're more open about what we want out of our software because we know that the software developers are listening. Whereas if you're dealing with non-free software, that's just not the model. Free software listens to the users because that's just how the thing develops. That's part of the way that it works usually. Whereas non-free software, they're not really set up that way, and they're not interested in being set up that way mostly. I've not really heard of that many proprietary software vendors soliciting ideas from the public. They're more than happy to take your money, but not so much your ideas on how their software should run, and sometimes detrimentally so. We've all heard of the major software company making some kind of radical change and upsetting their entire user base to the point of people just walking away from it sometimes. So it does work differently. There's not the solicitation or feeling that there's any interest in hearing ideas from people who are unhappy with some aspect of some big, expensive proprietary software. Speaking of expensive, the psychology, I think, of okay, I've just spent $1,200 for this piece of software. How much time am I going to really spend complaining about it online when I also don't feel that the company's even going to listen to me anyway? In a weird way, there's a sort of habit to tell yourself that you're okay with this software because it's clearly something valued very highly, whether you paid the $1,200 or not. But you know that the world tells you it's worth $1,200, and so should you really be complaining about it? And there's probably even some sense that it's not that the software is broken, it's that you just aren't doing it right. And strangely enough, I think that oftentimes there's a lot of that going on in free software, where the software does exactly what you're looking for it to do, you just don't know how to do it. So you jump online and complain about it, and someone in a comment answers you, oh, just do this, and then suddenly everything's fixed. You don't take the post down, but it is there. It's online. It's your complaint of why doesn't this thing have this function, and then someone tells you where that function is, and it's like, all along it was there, but that's the way you get help in free software. You announce that you're having trouble and people answer you. In proprietary software, and this is a big one, there isn't that either. I mean, if you've ever been to at least the corporately sponsored websites for a lot of these non-free applications, you will find that the amount of help is just completely, almost entirely useless. You know, I mean, it usually boils down to call support for assistance, and they give you the number, and they say, you know, if you're over your 90-day warranty, then you'll have to pay $40 to get your call answered. You know, I mean, it's just there's nothing, or the users just don't even know the answer, so they tell you that you probably shouldn't be trying to do what you're trying to do. It's usually very, very useless. Like, if you're used to linuxquestions.org, and then you go to a corporate site for some big proprietary software seeking assistance on anything, it's a completely different experience, at least in my experience. It's been a completely different experience. So I think there's a lot less expectation of getting help like there is. I mean, the free software community has built up a reputation. Hi, we like to help people for free. And people know that. And so they will announce trouble. They will ask for help. And proprietary software has basically trained people that asking for assistance is either bad or expensive. And so they shouldn't do it. And then finally, of course, there's the eternal marketing machine that does exist for proprietary software. They've got money. They can send copies to big sites for review. They can send free stuff to these journalists so that they feel, maybe not consciously, maybe not thinking, wow, I just got a free copy of this software, I'm going to give it a great review. But it feels special to get free software, you know? When, I mean, free, as in I didn't have to pay $1,200 for it, but it cost $1,200. The world is telling you, hey, this is worth a lot of money, and you just got a free copy of it, and now you're supposed to review it. You might think, oh, I'm a journalist, I'm not being influenced by this. I mean, supposedly, that's what they all say, right? So I'm assuming that's what they're telling themselves, that they're not going to be influenced by this gift. And yet, at the end of the day, their review is either quite positive, or it comes from the basis of, well, I know a lot of people like the software. I know this is a very good software. I just happen to not like this version. You know, it's coming from that sort of weird, it's not wrong, it just wasn't for me feeling. Whereas if you hear negative reviews about free software, it's oftentimes, oh, I can't believe the developers did this. It's completely stupid. This is really showing how patchwork free software is, blah, blah, blah. So it's a different psychology, I think, and a different amount of money being spent, of course, because if you can buy advertising and if you've got a big fancy corporate site and you can throw on that site all kinds of positive reviews and get lots of expensive partnerships with lots of big companies, suddenly there becomes like this entity of positive review, positive outlook about your proprietary software. So there's a big difference there too. But I think in what is becoming sort of an unintentional theme for Season 7 of the GNU World Order is the realization that the GNU Linux way is different, and it's okay to be different, and it's okay not to have all that kind of, I was going to say blatant propaganda, but maybe it's not so blatant, but all that propaganda out there just insisting that everything is okay with our software. Everything's fine with our computing platform and the software that runs on it, and if you're ever having any problem with it, then obviously there's just something wrong with you. It's definitely not our computing platform. It's definitely not our software. And Linux doesn't do that. The GNU Linux community is open about the problems, open about the strengths. They love to help, and that's what you get when you come to GNU Linux. You switch to this platform, you're not getting the prettified, packaged up, make sure it looks good no matter what kind of deal. You're getting just an open and honest community that knows that there are strengths and weaknesses within different areas, and they're willing to help, and they're willing to take ideas. It's very much a collaboration, and that's such a huge hurdle, I think, for people to get over, because if you've been around computers for even 10 years of your life, then that's what you've been trained to think of as a computer. You know, you don't come to it as a collaboration. That's not what you come to expect. The same thing happens when you go to an experimental art show of some sort, where they expect the audience to partake or something like that, where you're supposed to be part of the artwork, or you're supposed to go in and touch the exhibits or something, or sing along, you know, whatever you're supposed to do in this sort of, like, you are the audience and yet you are part of the event. It really freaks people out at first. You know, they can't get into it because we're not trained that art is supposed to be participatory or collaborative. It's supposed to be something that we are presented with in a nice, pretty package. And when you remove it from that consumerist point of view, then people get really confused at first until they kind of ease into it and realize that actually this is a really cool way of doing things. This is involving. It's giving them a sense of purpose. It's giving them something to do, to think about, to try, to experiment. They have a voice all of a sudden. They didn't know they had a say in any of this. They didn't know they could just make requests. Kidding me? You can just ask for a feature and it might just appear? It's really different. And again, that's one of the strengths of GNU Linux. And I don't think that we should at all be ashamed or hiding that at all. I think that's something to let people know about. When they're looking at the operating system that we all run and all the applications, it doesn't need to be packaged for them. You don't need to sell it to them. It's something that they can get involved with. And if they don't want to get involved with it, then again, just maybe they're not quite ready for it. I mean, not that there can't be people who don't who don't contribute and stuff like that. I understand that not everyone wants to get into the development side of software. Heck, I'm not a developer. I'm not getting into it. But and I mean, I report bugs and stuff. But even so, people don't even want to do that, maybe. But that doesn't mean that they can't still understand that they're in a community now. And if they don't want to be in a community, then maybe that's just a terminology that they don't like. But it's a lot more open, and a lot more open to ideas and feedback and communication than the proprietary stuff that's out there that is basically in this glass cage that you can use, you can look at it, you can kind of do what it's there for, but anything else you can't really do anything with, and you're not really supposed to talk bad about it, because probably not its fault, it's probably your fault, you're probably the problem. It's a good thing that GNU Linux is different. And actually, I should mention that I think that the whole propaganda, or let's concentrate on the positive stuff, I think that kind of media is actually really good, and I mean, I like it just as much as everyone else. That's why I go to sites like DistroWatch, and, let me think, LXER sometimes has a lot of that stuff. Even, like, a site like OMG Ubuntu, you know, I mean, as crazy as that site is, it's just about how great Linux is, and that's a really refreshing thing sometimes. It's just, yeah, I don't want to go to a site necessarily and read about, this was great except for this, this, and this, and this driver issue, and this problem, and I had to tweak this, and I never did like that desktop anyway. You know, I don't want to read that all the time. Sometimes there's too much honesty, and you do kind of want the mindless propaganda, hey, here's all the great stuff that I love about this Linux thing, and that's really fun, and I think there's a place for that, and I think a lot of people like that. I think people from the proprietary world like that. I think that it can be taken too far, like I said, where you kind of accidentally set expectations so ridiculously high for your specific application or something that people try it and then get disappointed, and I guess that's just a problem. That's just something that everyone has to balance in the way that they present things, and that's not just a software problem. But I do think that there's a definite place for these really, really uber positive, very nearly propagandic sites. I think they're fun to read. I think it's refreshing to hear about how great the operating system that we all run is. You know, I mean, you want to hear that stuff. You want to hear the rave reviews. That's a fun and positive kind of thing to have, so I wouldn't want that to go away. But at the same time, I like that that's not all there is, that it's not just this sheen of, oh, look, everything's perfect, everything's fine. Don't complain. Don't expect anything to ever go wrong, because nothing ever does go wrong. Even ignore those posts on the other sites that say something's wrong. Nothing goes wrong. You know, that's just lying to people. And it might be a comfortable thing to read when you're online, but it's a lot more realistic to do things the GNU Linux way, where you rave review some stuff, but you also let everyone know that there's no perfect application, there's no perfect OS. We all have issues, we all have something that we don't know how to do yet, whatever, and here are those issues as well. That's the end of the show, so thank you for listening. This has been episode 10 of season 7 of the GNU World Order. I'm Klaatu. You can reach me online at the GNUworldOrder.info, GNUworldOrder.info. You can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. I'm also notklaatu@jabber.org if you want to IM. On IRC, I'm on the irc.freenode.net network, and my nick on there is notklaatu. So thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time.
Kaj tamen tiu ideo estas iom stranga.